You're listening to the Modern Web Podcast. For more podcasts, videos, and events, find us online at modern-web.org or follow us on Twitter at modern.web. That's modern.web.
Carter Rabassa, head of developer relations for DataStax, discusses the democratization of AI and the challenges developers face with AI today.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this episode of the Modern Web Podcast. My name is Tracy. You can follow me on Twitter at Lady Leet or on LinkedIn at Tracy S. Lee. And I'm here with Adam Rackus today. Hello. Adam. You can find him on Twitter at Adam Rackus. Did you add me on LinkedIn yet?
Next week, I promise. I'll
still not. It's been months. Okay. You should add Adam on LinkedIn, Carter, because then actually everybody add Adam on LinkedIn, because then he'll feel some pressure and then maybe he'll add me on LinkedIn one day.
You know? LinkedIn is
but anyways, LinkedIn should sponsor. I love their lunches. And then Ben Lush is also actually Ben. I don't even know if I follow you on LinkedIn. I should.
I don't know. I think you do. I mean, it's been a long time. Like, at least it was back when I used LinkedIn more. So,
Yes. So anyways, you can follow Ben on Twitter at Ben Lush. And then we are here with Carter today. Hi, Carter. Welcome.
Hey. Hello.
Carter. So Carter does a lot of things. He is one of the organizers of Cascadia.js, which is an amazing conference, which everyone should go to. When is it? June?
It's end of June. It's June 19th to the 22nd in Seattle, Washington.
Yeah. So I'll be there. You know, it's a conference. It's like JavaScript and AI, right?
Yeah. It's like JavaScript, web, like just basic web platform stuff, plus a sprinkling of AI this year.
Cool.
Two-day conference, single talk track, super fun. If you've ever been to like a JS conf or a node conf, you'll fit right in.
Yeah. So CascadiaJS.com.
Is that? Yeah, CascadiaJS.com.
Great. Okay.
Tickets are on sale.
Yes. Sponsored by Cascadia.js. So anyways, but yeah, Carter is also the head of DevRel over at DataStax.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. So yeah, so DataStax is a data platform company. About 9 months ago or so, we launched a really cool thing called the vector database, which I think we're going to have some fun talking about on the episode. So if you're in the know, you can go check out datastax.com and check out our vector database, which is called AstroDB. If you don't know what a vector database is or why it's cool, then stick around and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah. And also I need help setting up my first vector database. So stay tuned because we're going to learn it live. Not today, but later. So Ben and Adam actually have no idea what a vector database is.
Yeah, we
kind of. Tracy does.
We discovered that on the kind of pre-conversation. But look, I think, I run Cascadia.js, which is a conference. I also help run like just the local Seattle JavaScript meetup. Super plugged into a lot of developer communities in the web and JS space. So, but you know, Adam and Ben are in really good company. Like I'd say 95% of people that I talk to they either don't know what a vector database is or they've like never used one. So I think it's totally normal. But I definitely think that that's something that's going to change in the next 12 months. So.
Well, there's plenty of JavaScript language features that people don't know exist or
I think one thing that like totally sold me when Carter and I were talking about like, you know, all this I don't want to hand wave AI, but like, okay, you know, AI stuff is like this idea that like, okay, you know, Ben, you used to work at Netflix, but like look, Netflix is going down because anybody can build a recommendation engine now.
Yeah. Ben, were you there when they did like the $1 million challenge?
No, I don't think so. What was the $1 million challenge?
Recommendation.
Oh, have a million.
Super famous. I mean, this is back in like, I don't even know. I don't like the late 2000s or something. Yeah, I mean, it was very, very early. Yeah. It was very early in Netflix's like days and they put out a $1 million challenge to anybody who could like build a better recommendation algorithm than whatever they had currently shipped, right?
If Ben was there during the $1 million, he wouldn't be here right now. He'd be like in Tahiti or something.
That's right.
Yeah, no, they had a recommendations team when I was there. So my guess is that was after.
And I think that's Tracy's point, right? The point is like, look, I mean, like machine learning and recommendation algorithms have been around for like a decade or more. The problem is they're incredibly difficult to implement. They require entire like engineering teams and organizations. So, you know, if you're just a regular web developer that wants to build, you know, like a better version of Goodreads, in the past, like your ability to like build a really quality recommendation feature was just kind of limited, right? Like these were, you didn't know how to do it. It felt out of reach. But I think with the tooling that has shipped in the last 12 months, like now, like just about any web or JavaScript developer can feel like these things are available to them. You know, like the technology has been democratized in a sense.
Yeah. So are we competing with Netflix tomorrow? No,
I hope so, man. They keep raising the price.
This is all part of Carter's plan to get bought out by Netflix. Make him go away.
Isn't DataStacks a public company?
No.
Is Carter going to get bought out, or is DataStacks going to get bought out?
Carter's going to be in Tahiti next week.
It's funny. You guys are focused on Netflix, but like I'm legitimately looking for like a Goodreads competitor because like I think Goodreads, ever since they got acquired by Amazon, has just done gone
that's why they went down. Their public API abandoned. That's unfortunate.
Of course, it's total garbageware. I think that like anyone who wanted to build a better thing, like at least maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, there's a lot of problems when it comes to bootstrapping social products. But now, just in terms of like certain parts of the technology that are required to build the experience, like that's something you can check off the list. You can be like, oh, cool, like we can totally do that part of it. Like when I was talking to Tracy earlier, like I know that we're going to get into kind of a generative AI kind of conversation, like what is generative AI? Like, why does it matter? How do vector databases fit in? But, when I was talking to her earlier, like to me, like vector databases are really cool for developers to just think about outside of the context of generative AI. Like I just, when I was, I'm dating myself. But when I was building web applications for the first time in the early 2000s, I worked at a company that used Oracle. And I know Oracle's a gross, disgusting company and a really crappy product. But one thing that Oracle had that MySQL didn't have at the time was a sophisticated, fuzzy search capability in the where clause. You could select blah from blah where, and then you could kind of, there was like a function you could execute that would do fuzzy searching on text columns, on varchar columns. And it was like pretty awesome. And MySQL had nothing like it. And as a developer, like I got really used to it. Like you could build e-commerce websites or any kind of website where the user is typing stuff in, and you could do these fuzzy matches that would return, you know, results, even if the user didn't use the exact right word. And I think after MySQL won and like other MySQL derivatives kind of won, developers forgot how nice it was to have fuzzy search. And I think vector databases like help bring back like fuzzy search and similarity search. And the minute you start playing with it, you can imagine all kinds of ways to use it in the web applications that you're building that have nothing to do with AI, right? You're just sort of creating fuzzier, better experiences like based off of the ability to match things, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me about this whole push towards AI. So we're getting better and better at the technology to help, if you will, fuzzy search and then come up with predictive technologies that can, you know, kind of guess what the next things are via probability engines, whatever. The real problem, and this is still a problem at Netflix and will be a problem no matter how great the machine learning gets, is like, how do you quantitatively measure the success of your algorithm, right? So I know a long time at Netflix, for example, they're like, oh, well, we can measure it by how many play starts we have. But then if someone starts the movie and they only watch for 5 minutes and they think it sucks and they turn it off, that's a failure. If you measure by how long they engage with something, I mean, they could have walked away, right? Like, how do you know what they left up? So like, measuring the success of your recommendations engine or your, you know, your especially commerce based thing. Like the only thing you can do is like sales is really easy. So if you're selling things, then yeah, okay, sales go up, then that's pretty quantitative. But like the other stuff, like books, for example, book recommendations, all these things become very, very hard to measure whether or not you were successful in your recommendation or your AI and guesses.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think my only thinking along the along those lines is that measuring the success of your I would definitely encourage people not to worry about measuring the success of the recommendation engine like in isolation. Like prior to even having implemented a recommendation engine, there should be sort of definitions of like the usability like of a product like in general, right? Because once again, like even if you take away recommendation engines from Netflix, like, you know, people still sign up for Netflix, they use Netflix, right? So there, in general, there should be higher level ideas about how usable and how good your product is. And then I think if you can really like nail those things down, then any kind of feature, whether it's a recommendation engine or something else, you have a baseline that you can work off of to figure out like, oh, great. Like, you know, has the addition of this feature improved like these numbers and these KPIs that we define in advance of the feature, right? That way, I think you're kind of doing apples to apples. That's the direction that I would sort of like point people towards.
Yeah, so like there's this, I've been talking to a lot of people about generative AI lately, and myself and Jerome Hardaway are doing this like series, which you'll hear on the Modern Web podcast as well. If you haven't already, of like these different levels of AI understanding. So like number one is destroying the bias, which I think Adam and Ben, you guys already use ChatGPT. Yeah. So I know Ben does. I remember Ben talking about using it.
Occasionally.
Yeah. So y'all
use it.
So
we every day, all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we don't need to, you know, there's no bias, you know, we don't have to say, please use it. You should use it. And then it's like using ChatGPT. So improving workflows. Like, have y'all ever made GPTs? Anybody meeting?
I've fiddled with it, but I haven't found that super useful yet.
Yeah.
Not yet.
And then like prompt engineering, which I think is like step three, which is, you know, I mean, you know, probably, you know, getting better at talking to the machine now that you're using ChatGPT. And then the fourth, which I think Carter's talking about, is this whole idea of like building with APIs, leveraging them, you know, building products with them. And then the fifth is like using LLMs and SLMs. Like, have you guys done number four? And like, what's stopping you from building with APIs? Like the AI APIs.
What kind of APIs? Which APIs?
Well, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, Carter, you got some APIs. Why aren't we using them?
I think web developers are like super comfortable building on top of APIs, right?
Yeah.
I think the challenge is really going from step four to five, right? I think like what many web developers find challenging is like, look, open, like all these LLMs have APIs, right? Mm. I think the challenge that a lot of developers face and engineers face is that like in most scenarios, like you make a single API call to like, you know, whatever Twilio or Stripe or like whatever you're accustomed to, it's to accomplish a specific task, and you expect a very, very like specific result. And then the interaction between your application and the API is over. I think LLMs are non-deterministic, and sometimes like it's chatty. Like sometimes you call out to an LLM, it returns with a response. And then based on that response, like you might call it again. And there can oftentimes be this non-deterministic ping pong between your app and the LLM based on this like non-deterministic situation that's happening. And I think a lot of developers find that really challenging, right? This is hard to wrap your head around it. It's one of the reasons that tool chains like LangChain or Llama Index like have been created in the first place, to create an abstraction layer so that the developer maybe doesn't have to care about that ping ponging. Like they know what they want. They ask for it, and then there's a bunch of chatter that happens, and then ultimately, like the result is returned to the application. I think that stuff's really challenging, and I think it's why you see a lot of tools getting built to sort of create better abstractions for web developers to use.
I mean, it's basically what we saw in JavaScript too, right? Like, JavaScript, it's frameworks. Sorry, Ben, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, so my comments earlier about measuring success, I think we're taking the wrong way. Like, LLMs, why would you use them if you can't even measure how successful you are? More to the point, what I actually meant is, I think that we're in the very primitive stages of using machine learning and AI still, even though it's getting more and more advanced, in that until we have an inversion of control, like really the power is kind of minimal. Like right now people are using LLMs as a tool where they tell the LLM what to do, and the LLM gives them a response, and they send a request and they get a response, and they send a request and get a response. And like, that is a very primitive way to use technology like this, in my opinion, because it would be better to be able to feed it information that like all the information that you had live and in such a way that it could build up responses and or push requests to you that you would respond to, right? So if you were, instead of saying like, oh, I want to build a game, what's my first step? You would say, I want to build a game, I want to do the XYZ. And as you were working on it, it could see what you were doing and be like, no, you need to do this next. You should be thinking about this. Please look at this. Like, if you wanted to, let's say if you're a company and you were like, my goal is to take 20% of the market share by XYZ, and you fed it continuous streams of data, and every day you checked and it told you what you should probably do or look into, that's inversion of control, where like all of a sudden this machine learning algorithm is much more powerful because it doesn't depend on whatever the human being happens to think of at the time. In order to, it can come up with however many ideas it needs to and run probabilities on them and push the best chances to you in that manner. So what I was getting at is, you could measure the success of your, you know, whatever your recommendation engine is, with a even more powerful LLM or some sort of machine learning that took all of the inputs, because like Netflix, is they collect way more data than they host movies. I can tell you that factually. And you take that information and you use that to drive and like figure out like whether or not you're successful or come up with metrics for success or whatever. And you still have to have a human element in there. But I just really think that we're kind of using it I use it in silly ways. Like, I need to know this, and then it tells me the answer, right? I wish I could feed it more live information about what I was doing and what my goals were. And it would just tell me, hey, you're.
Can you build this for the stock market? Because I want to build it for the stock market, even though like you can't release it publicly. Is that illegal?
This stuff is absolutely being built for trading.
Yeah, for sure.
1,000,000%. Yeah.
And Ben, like the everything you're describing like seems totally doable, right? I mean, I think like a lot of your personal experience with generative AI is coming from like an app, you know, called Copilot, right? Or an app called ChatGPT. But the underlying desire that you have, where it's like, hey, like I wish like these LLMs could be fed like, you know, data, you know, like maybe private data, like what am I working on? What are my goals? Like, you know, what is my progress incrementally? You know, having that data be fed to those things in order to like better inform like next steps. Like, I mean, that's how Copilot works, right? I mean, you use Copilot, you start typing, and it kind of like looks at what you're typing. You're like, oh shit, are you trying to like do a Fibonacci function? And it just autofills like the rest, right? Like that's right. A trivial example of what you're describing. One thing that I find fascinating though, is like, I always just keep going, I'm not really a big picture guy. I probably should be, given that I work in DevRel and marketing, but like I nerd out on like these details. Like, did you all know that you can use OpenAI to ask certain questions, and you can feed it. You can also feed it, you know, private data like in this context window. But you can give it a JSON schema, where like it will sort of like do its best to fit whatever response data it comes up with into your JSON schema. Like, you can use OpenAI to basically build ad hoc dynamic APIs that will return data in the exact shape that you want it to be. Like, that stuff just blows my mind, right? I just immediately, it actually like hurts my brain. Like, you could build your own weather API. You could be like, hey, what's the weather in San Francisco like today? And return the data in this exact JSON format, right? And then you as a web developer, like, great. Like, you know exactly what the data is going to look like, and you pop it into your React component and presto, you've got this thing, right? Like those things like make my brain hurt because you start to imagine as a building block, like, oh my God, like what more could I do with this? And not just with public data, but like with this private data, like, you know, my movie data or book data or, you know, my company's financial record data or whatever it is, right? Like, how do you merge these things together, give it this programmatic result that you want, and then be able to act on it? Like that stuff's wild. And then of course, like, I don't know if you all had a chance to check out, you know, the AI, Vercel AI SDK announcements this past weekend, but like, that stuff's crazy, right? You know, you've got Guillermo.
Oh my gosh, tell us about it.
I wish I had more time to have spent with it. I think the very high level story about what they're releasing is that they're, you know, the classic, you know, the classic, like, you know, generative AI experience that their older Vercel AI SDK enabled was like text. You know, it's like, look, like you could use their SDK as a JavaScript, you know, React developer to build like a really beautiful front end experience for like a chat application that included support for like streaming responses and stuff. Like it was amazing, and like a lot of it bootstrapped like a lot of great work that developers have done. And I think like the announcement is that they're basically moving from like text responses to like custom component like web responses. So like Guillermo built a demo where like you just ask the chatbot like give me Pac-Man, and then the response is literally like a Pac-Man web component, or I should say React component, or I should probably say like net like React server side component or an RSC, right? that literally like renders Pac-Man right there, and you can like use your arrow keys to play, right? So I think that's the big announcement. And then they've also just indicated that they're going to keep going, right? They're going to keep trying to figure out like, what more can we give developers to like actually make these generative AI experiences like delightful for end users, right? Like that's kind of, I think that's what their sort of mission is. Cause like, you know, Vercel's they're not a database company, and they're not an LLM company. And like, there's all these other like tools that are required to make the experience happen. But I think it seems to me that Vercel is investing a lot of engineering effort to like make sure that the actual thing that the user is touching and feeling is like as amazing as it can be. And then they're giving developers the tools to like light up these experiences in their apps. So yeah, it's like, it's super cool. Like I wish I had more time to work on it.
Yeah. Does that take away from like Vercel's, like, what is Vercel? Okay, wait. Should we even be having that conversation? What is Vercel trying to do? And it's funny because, right, you see, I mean, you know, even Carter with DataSex, right? Like, you see a lot of companies kind of saying, like, okay, you know what? This generative AI or AI stuff is amazing. And then let's go all in on that versus whatever path or strategy that we had before.
I think. I'd love to hear from like Adam and Ben on this, but like my short answer mm-hmm. is that like, you know, I've been to a lot of conferences and I've seen people from Vercel give talks about Next and about like what they cared about. And I think a few years ago, they felt like e-commerce and certain classes of websites and web apps were like, I don't know, they were like, if you had to rank the different kinds of websites on the internet in order of like, I don't know, importance or like or revenue or financial like outcomes, like, you know, e-commerce was like at the top of the list, and they were really optimizing Next to like, if you were building an e-commerce site, like use Next, it's performant, it's fast, all these things. I just think that they're looking at the future and they're like, holy smokes, we imagine a world where like hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of like really important future websites have these generative AI capabilities baked into it. And I think that's what they believe. And then I think that you just see that getting informing the roadmap for things like Next and things like the Vercel AI SDK.
Sometimes it's hard to bridge the gap between business objectives and tech implementation, and it can get messy. This dot is trusted by top names like Meta, Google, and T-Mobile, and they love helping business leaders fulfill their strategic digital initiatives. Check them out at thisdot.co. One more time, that's thisdot.co.
You know, I when this topic comes up, I think it's so much bigger than like a lot of the talking heads and the Twitterverse and tech really consider. Like, the companies I would be concerned with, like Vercel wouldn't even be in the bottom of that iceberg. Like the, like, honestly, I would be concerned with like the Palantirs and the Lockheed Martins and the Anduril's and these like defense contractors with multi-billion dollar budgets that are working on things related to this and that will be working on LLMs that don't have scruples, right? Like they're not going to be like, oh, I can't talk about that because it sounds violent like ChatGPT does, right? Like that's not a, like, and especially once those groups, and I'm sure they've already figured this out, figure out what I was talking about earlier, the whole inversion of control thing. Like, what if the machine learning gave you instructions instead of the other way around? Like, or it was a little bit more interactive in that manner. Like, that's, I mean, just imagine a country that spies on all of its citizens that does stuff like that. I'm not saying the United States, but, you know, countries in general that have CCTV of every one of their citizens and keep scores on their citizens. And we know which countries do that, right? Like, imagine a country like that developing technology, spending billions on something like this. And like, you know, that's, I look at it and I'm like, this is really, really cool. And then I think, what would I do with this if I was an evil trillionaire like organization, right? Like what bad could this wreak? And I'm a little curious to see how some of these things play out. If anything, the government has always classically been behind the rest of the world in technology, right? But it's not always the case when it comes to defense contracting. Like, some of the stuff they come up with is pretty spooky. So I don't know. That's what I kind of am keeping my eyes on. I think all the stuff that we work on is kind of, no, like I think I use it all the time and I think it's great. I'm more scared about my data and like, what do I have out there? What's going to be looked at by these things? Who's going to be looking at it with these things? Like, that's a little concerning to me, or like my kids' lives and those things. Like, I'm probably past that hump. Like, by the time the AI gets good enough, it's really going to crack down on me and my whatever I'm doing. I will be so old, I won't care. But like, I don't know.
You,
like,
think about your parents getting hacked and all those other things now. Imagine what AI can do when you get to that age.
Oh yeah. I mean, they could literally call your parents and like right now there's technology where someone could use it to call your parents and sound like you in trouble and make up a story. If they had enough of your data, make up a story that was totally believable about where you were, have details and information that, you know, it shouldn't really know, or divine information it shouldn't really know. Like, it's for even produce a video or an image. Like, it's insane the stuff that could be accomplished just today with some minimal effort by people who knew what they were doing. And like, eventually it won't even require the people who knew what they were doing, right? Like, it'll just be a machine able to do it. Like, hey, screw up Adam Rackus and like, you know,
already done.
Use toast. Yeah.
What I found kind of interesting in my conversation with Jerome about just kind of developers in general around the world is, you know, he said, you know, I mean, the US, I think, you know, there's kind of like hesitancy, I feel like, you know, a lot of people still are kind of at the stage one of this whole like idea that, you know, we kind of need to be unbiased about it, or a lot of people are biased about, you know, I don't want to use ChatGPT because XYZ. Right. Or maybe they're stage two. But then, you know, he said something that really struck me was that he said developers in Asia, though, are like, this is the reality. OK, how are we going to use it? Yeah. So the mindset when it comes to adopting technologies around this is very different in Asia than it is here. And so does that mean, like, you know, does that mean Asia is going to advance faster than us because they've gotten over all the humps and they're already using it and they already accept it as part of the future?
That's complicated, right? Because there's cultural differences and other things that affect that outcome. Mm-hmm. But like, I will say that I do think that anyone that's avoiding using Copilot and ChatGPT and they're avoiding it for reasons, they're going to suffer for it, because the reality is these things exist and they exist now. And like, I can type up some code and I can say, you know, LLM generate tests for this. And it does it within like 95% accuracy. And I go through and check it and change a few things and I'm done with my work. and go get a cup of coffee while you're sitting there for the rest of the next 2 days writing all the code that it just wrote, right? Like it's not gonna take people's jobs. Like all the worries about that, I don't think that's the real scary bit here. Like people will still want to deal with people. Like it might take some minimal management jobs eventually when people figure out that inversion of control thing, because there'll be people at the top who own everything and people at the bottom who are doing things, and all those people in the middle could be replaced with like a, you know, something that makes those decisions for, like, that's a little scary, but like, I don't know. Like, I don't think it'll take away jobs. I do think the bigger problem will be like the weird socioeconomic impact of having this thing manipulating markets and militaries.
I would like to manipulate the market.
The middle manager jobs are already going, and it's not because of AI. Companies are like, yeah, we don't need those roles. It turns out a lot of the director roles, it's not a good place to be if that's where you are. But
ooh, hot take, Adam.
No, it's not. There's
been a few articles. Like product manager roles are going away, right? There's a lot more like onus put on the on like developers to.
And they go away until they come back, but yeah,
right. It was I forget who posted the article, but it's the director position in particular that is like under threat. A lot of those like upper middle managers, companies are wanting to flatten some of those hierarchies a bit, and that's the level that's sort of being targeted.
They
probably got that idea from a vector database that was powering it all along. That's what I think.
I mean, I'm excited to create a vector database for like the Modern Web podcast or something.
Yeah, yeah. This stuff is super cool. Like I've been like doom and gloom for like the last 10 minutes, but like seriously, this stuff, I use it all the time. I think it's super, super duper cool technology.
You're just trying to convince everybody else not to, so you have a leg up.
You know, it's the same exact problem we had when the internet was invented. Like governments had no idea how to regulate it. Governments still have no idea how to regulate it. And it grew so fast, it was beyond anyone's control. And I think this is going to be the second, like everyone's like Web3 was crypto. Cryptocurrency was a joke. I'm so sorry. Like that's not Web3.
Hello, this, have you checked Web4 your wallet lately? Because
I'm good. But like this AI is the next big thing, truthfully. Yeah. Like. It's going to affect everyone right down to your grandparents. Like it's a thing that's going to get everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a great conversation. I've used this metaphor a lot. Like, I mean, I think all of us are old enough that like, we've just grown up with software, interacting with software that was fundamentally about like radio buttons and dropdowns and clicks. Right. And honestly, most of those UI elements mapped directly to like columns in some relational database. Like that's just the software that we grew up on. And I swear, like, you know, I've got, my kids are teenagers, but anyone who has like younger kids, like, I don't think they'll ever use software that has radio buttons and dropdowns and, you know, these interfaces will be completely different. And they'll be different for these reasons, right? You know, like all the reasons that we're talking about, like, it's changing both like how developers like build software in the first place, but it's also like radically changing like end users' expectations in ways that like ultimately I think are good. I mean, I don't know if you all remember this. I remember when Rails came out, like literally like Rails 1.0, and like there was, and like I remember I was like a J2EE like developer, and you know, Java struts, and like I remember like what it would take to build a pretty complex web application, like how long it would take and all this code and stuff that I would have to write manually. And then Rails happened, and I could just like generate all this scaffolding, and like in 3 minutes I had like a fully functional, like bare bones, like administrative, like CRUD web application. And it was like, it was wild. And I remember thinking to myself, like, oh my God, so many developers are going to lose their jobs because of Rails. And it just like never happens. It's just like, yeah, okay, whatever. Like it turns out people are very adaptable and smart, and the world evolves, and, you know, like all these things sort of happen that like, you know, create new jobs where there were no jobs before.
And like, oh, now you have to manage AI. Now you have to manage costs. Just like
you need a web developer because the internet was invented. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Prompt engineering is like a real thing. Like, you know, you can't build anything you cannot build a single even decently sophisticated generative AI application without like spending a lot of time like doing prompt engineering, which is just, yeah. You know, it's not a skill that people have, but it's a skill that they'll acquire and they'll kind of like learn how to do it. And they'll learn about which tools can help them get better at it and that kind of stuff.
I bet a language model will figure it out.
Maybe, please
finish your thought. I didn't mean to talk over you. So you remember back in the early days of like Uber and Lyft when like it was all the costs were subsidized and then, you know, everything came due. Are we in a similar position like that with things like?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
It's like everybody loves the cloud until they get the cloud bill is how.
Yeah, but like, are those costs sort of hidden right now where the cost of ChatGPT is going to skyrocket in the future because OpenAI is just eating a lot of these compute costs and they're going to just not do that?
There's my usage alone. There's no way what I'm paying ChatGPT covers it. Like, there's absolutely no way because I use it to generate images and stuff all the time. Like, I guarantee I eat through my $25 or whatever it is.
Okay. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So yeah, we should expect. I mean, right now they're fishing for use cases, right? Like they're just trying to figure out, like, hey, like what are the, and then like just like airlines, like you should fully expect that, like in the future, like there will be like many, many different flavors of ChatGPT, like where they are segmenting their users and their use cases and all of these things. And by the way, it's not. And that's a comment about like the consumer end user ChatGPT. Same thing with OpenAI, right? Like right now they're hoovering up developers. They just want as many developers as possible to build on these APIs so that they can figure out like, ooh, like what are the juiciest, most valuable use cases? And then we should fully expect that like the product will segment itself over time. Like their pricing model will become more complicated rather than more simple. As they maximize, you know, as they sort of maximize revenue, like, you know, based on like these things. It's just normal. It's what we saw with AWS.
Capitalism.
Like
when they,
but it's kind of like, it's sort of fair. I mean, I think like what, I think what matters is that, I think to Adam's point, like, like if you're building a business, right. If you're building on the foundations of an OpenAI, like you should be really thoughtful about that. Like if you're expecting their pricing to be like rock solid into the indefinite future and your business model is predicated on that, that's a dangerous like assumption to make. Right. Like you should, you know, and ultimately it will force, and this is where like, it's not so bad. Like the crappier, like less valuable use cases will be sort of like priced out of existence. Right. But like the better things, the things where it's like, oh my God, I can't live without this. And I'm willing to pay for this. You know, those things will be rewarded.
Yeah. Well, this was so much fun chatting. So Carter, where do we find out more about you? Like,
you can find me on Twitter. I will never call it X. CRTR0. We could talk for hours about what I miss about that old place. You know what's funny? You can find me on LinkedIn, just Carter Rabassa, Rabasa. Uh-huh. It's globally unique. There isn't another Carter Rabassa in the world. I think I could actually argue that there has never been another Carter Rabassa in the world.
I'm literally not even connected to you. I'm changing that right now.
Yeah, isn't it funny that LinkedIn is a thing? I swear to God, most developers I talk to would like laugh at the idea of like having a LinkedIn account or being on LinkedIn, and like now it's like this thing.
That's pretty
wild. So so those are probably the two best places to kind of find me. I'm really friendly, you know, feel free to say hi, you know, shoot me a DM.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, everyone. And you know, we'd love to hear your hot takes on how AI is taking over the world or how you're using it or whatever you're building. And you know, if you are building some sort of thing for the stock market, send it to me. I'll use it. We'll see you all next time. Thanks a lot. Bye.
This podcast is sponsored by This.Labs, a framework agnostic consultancy that specializes in JavaScript. You can find them at this.co/labs. That's this.co/labs. For all of your friends and you, do-ba-do-do-do, yeah, query, shout it, yeah, queries too, so come on, let's go.
Cause we got a show for you.